Well, the slide's still up there. That's a good start. My computer's too high tech. Okay. So, I was going to start off a little bit at the beginning and just remind people that what we're looking at is in quantum computing is building circuits using the laws of quantum physics. So we have the basic building blocks of two-level systems. And the interesting feature is that a bit is in a superposition of 0, 1, unlike classical where it's just 0 or 1. And this is just a notation for writing this down. So alpha and beta are complex numbers, and it's a norm 1 vector. So those are the bits, and then we also have our gates, which are, to get quantum computing, you need 1-bit gates and a controlled knot, and then you get everything. So controlled knot, the truth table is down there at the bottom. It's just taking the, it's just flipping the second bit if the first bit is a 1, so that's the bottom two. So these are the basic operations that we need. So the question is, you know, are these powerful? Can we do things we can't do with classical computing? And so in Feynman, in 1981, Feynman pointed out that, classical computers cannot efficiently simulate quantum computers. Well, they can, but it takes exponential time, so it's not efficient. And one reason is that the state, once you have n qubits written down, the state becomes exponentially large. You need 2 to the n complex numbers to represent each state. And the modern Church-Turing thesis states that any Turing machine can efficiently simulate any device that's physically realizable in principle. Yet here we have, with quantum computers, we have a device which is, in principle we can implement it, but we can't simulate it. So this is the only model that violates the Church-Turing thesis. So on the one hand, quantum computers can do something amazing because they can simulate their own dynamics, which we can't do efficiently classically. And the question we want to answer is, what else can they do? Can we solve other problems faster that we say might be interesting to a computer scientist? So the first quantum algorithms that we found that could do something classical ones could not started in 1993 with the Bernstein-Vazirani problem. This is an oracle problem. And they achieved a super polynomial speedup. And then in 1994, there was Simon's algorithm, which was also an oracle problem, which achieved an exponential speedup, but it also laid the groundwork for Shor to find his algorithms for factoring discrete law. And of course, the big news is if you can factor integers, you can break RSA, and if you can compute discrete logs, you can break Diffie-Hellman. So there was a pretty long gap after that, but in the last few years, we've been finding new problems we can solve, such as Pell's equation, unit group, hidden shifts, and Jones polynomial. And I'm going to talk about some of these today. Okay, so in going slowly still, let me just tell you a little bit about the model. So a general state is a superposition of over all 2 to the n n-bit strings. So here we have, this is just an n-bit string in some funny notation, and this is the complex amplitude. And the whole thing is just a norm 1 vector. The evolution, as I said before, is by quantum gates, and it turns out the main primitive we have to use is the quantum Fourier transform. This is the main primitive we can compute efficiently that we can try and apply to things. And finally, after you evolve your state, you do a measurement. When you measure, you'll just measure some, just think of this as a classical bit string x, it's n bits, and you'll measure it with some probability, alpha, norm of alpha x squared, which is its amplitude here. And once you measure it, it destroys the state, and that's it. So what you can do is you can sort of repeat the process and gather statistics about what the state was. And so I'm going to show you an example of an algorithm. And one more thing before I show you that. So you can also do partial measurements. So if you have several registers, say you have 2 registers, what you can do is you can measure just one of the registers. So here we have 2 registers, left and right. And if you measure, say, the second register, the way it works is it just collapses to a superposition over states consistent with that. So if you measure the 5, you'll collapse to the superposition over the things with 5 in the second register. If you measure 6, you'll get this one. Okay, so to the main transform I mentioned before, the Fourier transform, this is just the familiar Fourier transform. You would input a quantum state. So here's a quantum state on 2 bits. It has 4 complex numbers. And you would apply the Fourier transform. This is the familiar 4 by 4, where omega is the 4th root of unity. And the output would be the Fourier transform of the quantum state. Now, there's sort of good news and bad news for the Fourier transform, the quantum Fourier transform. So first, the good news is the time to compute it. Classically, you're familiar with the fast Fourier transform takes time n log n, whether it's a capital N. But if you look at it in the number of bits, it's 2 to the n times n. Whereas in the quantum case, you can do n squared. So you have exponential speed up when computing the Fourier transform. That's the good news. Bad news is the access to the result. So as I said, in the quantum case, when you measure a quantum state, all you do is you sample n bits. Your state is gone. Whereas in the classical case, you would take a complex-valued vector, you'd get out a complex-valued vector, and once you have that, you can look at each individual complex number at their amplitudes, at their norms. So you have a lot more information sitting there. So trying to walk this line is part of designing quantum algorithms, exploiting the running time versus the access you have to the output. Okay, so let's look at an example. If there are any questions, please ask. Yes. Where does it say n log n? Oh, yes, that should be n. Yes, thanks. Yes, that should be an n. Okay, so let's start with a toy problem, and I'm going to generalize this as we go throughout the talk. So start with a simple one. So you're given a function on ZQ, so this is just integers 0, 1, 2, up to Q minus 1. And it has this property, it's a function to some set, say colors, and it's periodic, and it's one-to-one inside the period. So here's just a really tiny example where this function is periodic, it has period 4, 4, and so on. And it's also one-to-one, so it takes different colors between the periods. Now in general, this function is huge, and you can't just query the function to figure out what the period is, because you want to be polynomial time in log r, and the period might be exponentially large. So you have to do something else other than that. So there's a quantum algorithm that finds this period, of course, and it's two steps. The first thing we do is create a superposition which is periodic with period r. So here I'll show you the steps to do that. You first create a uniform superposition. You then evaluate f into the second register. So once you evaluate f into the second register over there, you sort of have the color sitting in superposition. And then finally, you measure that second measure. You do a partial measurement. When you do that, you measure a random color, because you measure, you just measure a random color, and then the superposition collapses to whatever is consistent with that color. So in this case, you'd be left with the orange, with the orange dots. Now, the reason why you can't just measure this and get the answer is because you're always going to have this random offset k sitting here. Each time you measure, you get a different random offset k. So you have to do something besides measuring again. So in the quantum case, I thought that was still the previous slide. So after you measure this, then what you can do is compute the Fourier transform, and what you will see is multiples of Q over R. This is assuming R divides Q. You get this nice picture on the right-hand side. And what happened was K, that offset, goes into the phase. And then they're all the same norm. So you just left on this nice superposition. So if you measure multiples of Q over R, of course you can compute R from that. And what we assumed here was that these multiples of R formed a subgroup of this thing. That's what the same as saying R divides Q. And so this sort of process works for any finite subgroup group pair. And so as we go on, we're going to talk about going up to the integers and to the reals, which goes to infinite and then uncountable groups. Any questions on that? Okay, so sort of jumping ahead to the most abstract thing, this can be thought of as a hidden subgroup problem. So one way to view what we know about quantum algorithms is to look at them in terms of the hidden subgroup problem. In this case, you're given a function on some group to some set, say colors, and they're constant and distinct on cosets of a subgroup H. So here are your group elements, there's some hidden subgroup H in here. You have a function on this group, and when you evaluate, you get these colors. So H is a subgroup. A coset is just a translate. So here are two more. Here are two cosets of H. And in the case we just saw, the yellow part was the period R. It was multiples of the period R. And you'd like to find a set of generators for H. So the structure of G determines how hard it is. Nicholas was just talking about, in the non-abelian case, how things are pretty hard. So starting with the abelian case, I guess you can summarize by saying we have quantum algorithms for a lot of the cases, for most of the cases. So for example, when you try and factor an integer n, the group would be the integers. When you solve discrete logs over finite fields, you would have a direct product of these two finite groups. And for Pell's equation, you would have the reals. On the other hand, when the group is non-abelian, this is a very important open question, because if we could solve it for the symmetric group, it would automatically give us an algorithm for graph isomorphism. And if we could solve it for the dihedral group, we would automatically get an algorithm for the unique Schrodinger's lattice vector problem. So if you look at what we know about exponential speedups, in terms of the hidden subgroup problem, you could sort of draw it out like this. So you have this abelian case, you have when the group is finite, like I mentioned, or if it's the integers, you can do things like factor, solve discrete logs. If it's abelian, but you're going up to the reals or higher powers of the reals, you'll get things like Pell's equation and the unit group. For these cases, we have algorithms. For the non-abelian case, we know certain things. We know Heisenberg group, we know some semi-direct products, some sub-exponential time algorithms. And as I mentioned, there are these two, these are the two open important problems. One of the questions is, can you take these techniques and continue them down to these two groups so we can solve graph isomorphism or unique shortest lattice vector problem? And then outside the hidden subgroup problem, we have maybe four things. Shifted Lagrange symbol problem, I'll talk about if I have time. There's also a random walk on a graph where you have an analog of a classical random walk. You have a quantum random walk, and it's taking a walk over some graphs. Recursive Fourier sampling I mentioned before, and then there's also the Jones polynomial. Approximating the Jones polynomial is actually BQP complete. Okay, so for the next part of the talk, I'll sort of go through how you can view these sorts of problems here. You're dealing with the abelian case. Okay, so that was the hidden subgroup point of view, but if we're just going to focus on sort of what we can solve, here's another way you can sort of think about things I want to try and tell you about, which is, if you say, what can we do with quantum computers? What do we know we can do it by, at this point? One answer you can give is that quantum computers are good at determining the basis of some lattice. So the lattice is given implicitly in some strange way, and for some reason the goal of the problem is to find a basis for that lattice. So let me say what a lattice is. So a lattice, you're given n, say, real-valued vectors and r to the n. And the lattice is just a set of integer linear combinations. So over here is a picture of a piece of a lattice. It shouldn't actually end at these axes. It should be everywhere. But, so you have pick a couple of vectors here and start taking integer linear combinations, and you'll get all these points. So, given a lattice, okay, here are two problems you might try and solve. Okay, let's look at the second one. The second one you may be more familiar with, which is given a basis for some lattice, find a shortest vector. This is a big open problem, and I guess Udit will be talking about this in his talk. And I'm going to focus on the first one, which is given some description of L, find a basis for L. So I'll show you how a lattice, try and show you anyway, how a lattice appears in all these problems. So the approach is, we'll define some function on r to the n, which is going to hide some lattice. So this is the way we're going to sort of make this, given some description, more concrete. We're going to be given a function on r to the n, and it's going to satisfy this hidden subgroup property, where if you take a lattice vector v, an f of x plus v equals f of v for everywhere, and it's distinct when you shift it by different cosets. And our goal is to compute the basis for that lattice. Okay, so let's start with an example. So this is an example where Microsoft leaves out a feature. So this is actually not on purpose. There's no way to get that off of here easily right now. I think in the next version it'll be there. Because I had to write that, I wrote that by hand. Okay, so factoring, right? When you factor an integer n, the way Shor's algorithm works is you pick a random element a mod n, and if it has even order, then what you'll try and do is you'll compute its order, and if you can compute its order, then you can just factor, you can factor this like this, and you'll have a factor of n. So the whole problem boils down to finding the order of an element A. So what you do is you define a hidden subgroup problem, and since f from the integers, z mod n, defined by f of I equals a to the I mod n. Now this satisfies these properties I was talking about. The hidden subgroup here is multiples of the order of A. It's a subgroup of the integers. So this is just a more general example of the toy problem I showed you, where we assumed that, you know, everything was finite. Now things aren't finite anymore because Z is not finite. So we'll still try and use the same approach. We'll just pick a large finite piece of the function to evaluate. This is what Shor did. So the algorithm here is, here you just pick some q. It's not necessarily a multiple of r. You evaluate the function in superposition like before, measure the value, so you get this periodic superposition. When you compute the Fourier transform, you'll still get something like multiples of q over r, but there'll be lots of noise around each peak. And the rest of the algorithm is, if you measure something like this, kq over r, if you compute the continued fraction expansion, if you divide by q, and somewhere in the expansion, you'll see r in the denominator. And so Shor showed that this works. If q is at least r squared, then you'll be able to reconstruct the period r. So that's extending it to z, and there are other cases that reduce to z. For example, the class group of imaginary number field here, you're given generators of a finite abelian group. The goal of that problem is to find the lattice of relations. That's the set of integers e1 through ek, such as g1 to the e1 through gk to the ek equals 1. This is a lattice. So you can define an HSP instance like this. And you can reduce it to the previous case. If you evaluate this on each axis, you'll get an instance of Shor's algorithm. And then what you have left over is a finite group, just like I showed you on the toy problem, except for in multiple dimensions. And another recent problem that was found to reduce this is computing the zeta function of a genus G curve over a finite field FQ. And this is in time polynomial in G and log Q by Kadlia. Okay, so that's over Z. Any questions over Z? Now I'll move on to R. So here's a problem, Pell's equation, where, so the input for Pell's equation is a positive non-square integer d, and you want integer solutions to this equation, x squared minus dy squared equals 1. And it's a fact that all solutions, x and y, have a form a and bn that can be written like this. They all come from this equation where there's something called the fundamental solution, a0 plus b0 square root d, and if you raise that to the nth power, it'll generate exactly the solutions of Pell's equation. So you can sort of think of the goal of solving Pell's equation as finding a0, b0, and then you'll have all the solutions. But just doing it like this, there's a big problem, which is, it's big because a0 and b0 are exponential size in general, and you can't even write down the answer. So there's a nice fix for this, which is to define the regulator. So instead of finding a0, b0, you find the log of this fundamental solution, just log of this. And then the goal is to output the closest integer to R. And this is what you mean by solving Pell's equation, output the closest integer to R. So any solution of Pell's equation now can be represented as an integer multiple because of the properties of log. And there are lots of classical algorithms to manipulate these things. So, for example, if you have R already, then if you're given, say, the closest integer to R, you can compute R to any precision. Or if you're given R, you can compute the least significant digits of this huge monster A0 plus B0 square root D. You can do this in polynomial time. In terms of the complexity, so factoring reduces defining R, solving Bell's equation, but a reduction in the other direction is not known. And the best classical running times for factoring is something like e to the n to the 1/3, and for Pell is something like e to the n to the 1/2. Now, of course, factoring was e to the n to the 1/2 until, what, 89 or so, and people didn't think it would go lower, and then a number field sieve was discovered, which created this gap between the two. So for complexity classes, factoring is an NP-intersect co-NP, and finding an integral multiple of the regular is an NP. So that means if you're given some, you know, approximation of a real number, there's a polynomial time algorithm to test if e to the x is a solution of Pell's equation. And if you assume generalized Riemann hypothesis, it's also the case that finding R itself, that is, you know, multiple 1, that's an NP. With no assumptions, it's not known whether finding the regular is in NP. So next we'll talk about, you know, sort of generally an efficient quantum algorithm that will find the regulator, and that doesn't need any assumptions, like the Riemann hypothesis. Okay, so just to give you some feel for what happens, where this comes from. So we saw in the integer, in the factoring case, you take a mod n and you raise it to a power to get this function that's periodic. So here things are actually a lot more complicated. So the input to the problem is this integer d, positive non-square integer d. And what you can do is define this a certain set of ideals inside this ring z adjoint square root d. And there are a lot of facts already known about this classically for computing with these ideals efficiently, classical algorithms. So first of all, between 0 and the regulator, so what you can do is you can take these ideals and plot them between 0 and the regulator. There will be an exponential number of them in that range, and they're, you know, they have some representation, which is a pair of integers. And you can speak about the ideals having some distance. It just means the distance from 0. So the distance is something, Now you can perform certain operations on these ideals, like you can multiply them. And multiplications, okay, if you look at, okay, I'm only, okay, if you're familiar with this, I'm only writing down reduced ideals. But, you know, when you multiply, you get other types of ideals, and then you reduce them to get reduced ideals. And when you look at only reduced ideals, then you get certain properties, like distances add approximately. So This notation I have here, I sub 2, means the ideal to the left is 2. So here's the ideal to the left of 4, the ideal to the left of 5. You can multiply this by itself, and it'll give you something around the ideals around 4. So you might get I4, you might get I5, and it's not known what you'll get without computing it. So it's group-like in that it's abelian, but it's not associative because of this property. Okay, and finally, given a real number x, so anywhere, you can compute the ideal that's closest to x in polynomial time. So here you can set up a function on R, all of R, and say, okay, suppose I give you this real number right here, give me the ideal to the left, it'll return I5. And this function is periodic. So here we have, you could have asked for the same thing at 5, and you would have gotten I5 too. So this is where you can get a periodic function from. Okay, so how do we find the period of this? I mean, sort of, I think the most natural thing to do is go back to the integer case. You can look at the integer case. This is just the integer case. I've just written it up here again. Here, the distance between every two points is this integer r. And, you know, if you compute, you get these things that look like k2 over r, and then you compute the continued fraction expansion. So for Pell's equation, we have a function that is periodic with period R, and you know, you can discretize it using what I showed you on the previous slide. The question is, what do you do? So, because now the periods are irrational, so this distance up here is no longer going to be the same every time. So one thing you could try and do is just reduce it to the integer case. Right, so the integer case would go R to R. Pell equation case would go capital R to R. And the problem is, this, as I mentioned, you'll have to evaluate this function on some huge range. And once you do that, the two functions become completely out of sync, and there's no way to just directly reduce it. But you can do something similar, by setting this, okay, this is supposed to be some approximate-looking thing, even though it looks exactly the same as before. And what you can show is that you'll get some good samples, but they'll be only in the beginning of the resulting distribution. So unlike before, all this stuff out here looks like garbage. And so if you were to zoom in, you'd get these things that are being rounded in various ways. So the distance between two points could be between R minus 2 and R plus 2. So you have some different properties. And the once you measure multiples of KQ over R, it's also a little different because now this R is irrational. And to figure out what an approximation to R, what you do is you measure two values and compute the ratio, compute the continued fraction expansion of that ratio, and you'll get what their integer multiples are, and then you can compute an approximation to R. So that's how that works for Pell's equation, the algorithm for Pell's equation. Q will be similar to before. I think it's still around R squared works. Okay, so I was saying you can look at things as finding a basis of a lattice. So far I've shown you these two one-dimensional lattices, right? So here's a weird description, and you want to try and find a basis. Finding the period of a one-dimensional lattice is the same as finding a basis for a lattice. But now these problems continue on to higher dimensions. And here you're really going to see a lattice. It's clearly a lattice. So the generalization of Pell's equation is finding the unit group of a number field. Given a number field, the unit group is something you want to find, and it's a lattice under some log embedding. The same way that Pell's equation was a lattice once we took the log of the fundamental solution. So the important thing is the last line. For constant degree number fields, there's this, you can define a function even on this higher space that can be evaluated in polynomial time. And this algorithm only works for constant degree, so we have to restrict the constant degree, even though there are number fields of arbitrary degree. We don't know how to solve that one. So in case you've only seen this once before and you're dying to know what the objects are, right? If not, you can just stay down here and then I'll catch up to you. So given a number in a number field, you have this log embedding where you take a number alpha to the log of its conjugates. And log has these nice properties, like log alpha times beta is log alpha plus log beta. And the main fact is, under the log embedding, the unit group O star is a lattice. So in general, you would write a unit like this, you know, epsilon I to k to the I. But once you take log, then all these things come down to be integer multiples of those log epsilon I. So the goal is to find a basis for this lattice. That's what it means to find the unit group. So the algorithm for this works. You set up this function. We know we can evaluate it. You evaluate it in superposition. Now, you're probably thinking, yeah, PowerPoint, it's really hard to get circles to line up in a straight line, right? But actually, this is really what the superposition looks like. So, because remember, these are actually points. Each lattice vector is described by a vector of real numbers. These can be irrational. So all of these points approximate some vector. So things really do get screwed up like this. And partly because of this, when you compute the Fourier transform, you start getting junk outside, just like in the one-dimensional case. But what you can show is in this inner box, you'll actually get good data. You'll get a good signal in there. Everything else you sort of ignore. And so, given the function, you create a superposition over the lattice points. It'll be a shifted version, which I didn't draw here, which is important. But K compute the Fourier transform. When you do that, you show you can sample from the dual lattice. And we know that classically, if you have a basis for the lattice of the dual lattice, they're polynomial time equivalent, more or less. I mean, for real numbers, you have to be careful. But even so, so you sample from here, you get a basis for the dual lattice, and then you use your classical algorithm to get a basis for the lattice. And that's how you find the unit group. So the main issue here is things start getting really noisy, and you start losing your signal. And it's still a question of what happens in higher degrees. Okay, so there's a next problem after the unit group, which is the principal ideal problem. So this one's even harder than the unit group, in the sense that there's a reduction. If you can solve the principal ideal problem, you can compute the unit group. So here you're given, again, the input's an integer d, and you're also given an ideal I, and you want to know whether it's principal. So that means, can you write it as alpha times the ring? So from our picture before, we have 0, we have the regulator, we have our ideals spaced out all over the place. Given one of these, or some other one, you want to know, is it on this line or not? So for example, if it is on this line, maybe you can compute its distance from 0. So the hardness, based on the hardness of this problem, there's a key exchange system by Buckman and Williams, which works like this. You have Alice and Bob trying to exchange a key. Alice chooses an integer and sends over the ideal to the left of A. Bob chooses an integer B and raises I to the A to the B, and that turns out gives you something like the ideal near A times B, and then Bob sends over I to the B. So this is like Diffie-Hellman. I think there are probably many details to actually get this to work. It's not as simple as I make. It's not quite as simple as I'm making it out to look, but that's the idea. So here, sort of the underlying problem is computing the distance of an ideal. So notice if we can solve the principal ideal problem, or compute the distance, if we can compute the distance of an ideal, then we can break this crypto system. Yes. Pairs of integers. Oh boy. It's a Z basis. Yeah, that's the whole point. Representation is crucially important. If you give it in the wrong representation, the problem can be easy. But in this representation, the problem is hard. Maybe I'll leave it at that for now. Okay, and so we can also find a quantum algorithm for this, and it's going to be by finding the basis for some lattice. So the approach is we define a function which hides some lattice. It's similar sort of discrete. It's similar to the discrete log problem. And I don't really want to get into the details, but you would set up a function which uses your given ideal, sets it up. And the claim is that the lattice that we're hiding has a certain basis with 1 minus x. So if x is the distance, you'll have 1 minus x as a basis, as a vector in the lattice. So once you compute the basis, you can compute minus x. So this is how you set up, there is a quantum algorithm for computing the distance of an ideal. So this quantum algorithm would break that key exchange protocol I showed you on the previous slide. Okay, I'll just mention this, and then I'll talk about the shifted Legendre symbol problem. So there's another problem called the class group. I mentioned the class group of a real number field before, where you have unique representatives. So one thing we need for this whole HSP algorithm to work is we need to have unique representation for each element in the group. But in the real number field case, you have a class group. Without saying it is what it is, okay, here's a class group of size 3, and you can compute with these ideals inside each element. So you can compute in the class group, but the problem is you don't have unique representatives. When you multiply two elements, you might get any one of the dots in here, and there's nothing you can do to compute it. It's unknown how to compute a unique representative. I just want to say that in the quantum case, you can get around this problem because you can actually create a quantum state which represents that element of the class group. because you can create a superposition over all the points inside there, right? So if you look back here and you say, okay, this box is a group element and you have all these points in here, we can create a superposition over everything inside one of these parallel pipettes. And that'll give us a unique representation for, wow, it's a magic button I didn't know was there. Okay. We can get a unique representation for each element in the class group. And just quickly, the idea is if you're given some ideal, right, so the ideal is just some representative for the class group element, you can split up into a superposition of grid points like over there. Inside there, you have these dots or all the different reduced ideals that we can actually compute with. And what you can do is use this algorithm I just showed you that computes the distance. So you compute a distance g, you compute the ideal, the reduced ideal near there. You use the previous algorithm to erase that distance, because now you can compute the distance of each ideal. And then you'll be left just with a superposition over the ideals in that class group. So that also allows you to compute the class group in real number fields, constant degree. Okay. So that's the last part. And I'll just spend a couple minutes talking about the shifted Lagrange symbol problem, since it's somehow related to cryptography. Okay, so let me tell you about a proposal for a pseudorandom function generator. So the setup is we have a finite field, FP, and of course we have addition, multiplication, P is an odd prime. And the Lagrange symbol, capital L, tells you whether or not an element in the field is a square or not. So it's 1 if it's a square mod P, and it's minus 1 if it's not. So, for example, for P equals 11, here's what the vector would look like if you just evaluated the Lagrange symbol. And you always get half 1s and half minus 1s, of course, right? Half the elements are squares and half are not squares. So you could try and design a pseudorandom function generator like this. You choose a random shift, right? So you have this vector. Choose a random shift and just cyclically permute that vector. So here I've just taken the vector up there and I've cyclically shifted it. And the goal would be to try and break it. So what you output is you output F, where F is the shifted Lagrange symbol. And these have various properties, like you can't predict what the output's going to be at certain inputs and some things like this. So, for example, there's a similar proposal by Damgaard for pseudorandom bits, but his is different, because what he does is he would take, say, this thing and just output polynomially many bits. You would only ever have access to polynomially many bits, whereas in pseudorandom functions, you have random access to everywhere. So the problem is this. Find F. Because we're trying to find F. Okay, so one way to break a pseudorandom function like this, the shifted Lagrange symbol, would actually be to compute S. If you compute S, you know everything about it. So this we actually can do with quantum algorithm. There's a polynomial time quantum algorithm. It seems different than a hidden subgroup problem, which we've been hearing about. And, it doesn't break Damgaard's pseudorandom bit generator. And the reason is we don't have random access. So our algorithm assumes you can evaluate this function anywhere. It does break certain algebraically homomorphic encryption systems, and the best classical algorithms for these are exponential time. In hindsight, you can also use Shor's algorithm to break these same things, but the algorithms seem somehow different. And if you like circuits, well, the circuits are a little different for the two problems, but this one has three Fourier transforms. Okay, and we'll talk about that. Okay, so just to mention some limitations we know of quantum algorithms. So, of course, there's weak evidence that we cannot solve NP-complete problems if you don't use the problem structure. We've seen examples where we cannot break zero-knowledge proofs. Zero-knowledge proofs are still secure. And, I don't know, maybe the non-abelian hidden subgroup problem is hard. Who knows? But I'll just stop here by listing the crypto systems I know of that are broken and not broken. So broken, of course, we've seen RSA, Diffie-Hellman, including elliptic curves. Anytime you have unique representation, you can break it. The Buckman-Williams key exchange, and also certain algebraically homomorphic encryption systems. And ones that are still safe, shortest lattice vector-based systems, such as iTide's work, Goldreich, Goldwasser, Halevi, the Michaelis crypto system, Entru, and certain systems that sort of lack structure, which, yeah. So I'll stop there. Thanks. I was just referring to the abstract definition. I don't know of actual implementations, how they work. I don't know if there is any actual implementation that's known.
What's the property? You want to be able to do sort of two types of compute, addition and multiplication?
Yeah, given an encryption, you should be able to compute their addition. Right. So they're proposed with these properties, but there's no known way to implement them. So.
Well,
there's which?
Pi-E?
No, I don't know. Yeah. It's a good question. No, that's Michaelis.
Yeah, they come about in some very special structures.
Yeah. And there's also algebra even before you get to the lattices, so maybe that could also be used. No, just there's just an abstract definition. Like, if we have a crypto system which satisfies a certain properties, we'll call that an algebraic homomorphic encryption system. So, don't know how to implement it, but you know that's what the definition is. And given one of those, we can break it. No, we have some. Okay, I'm not an expert on these things, but I mean, there's some assumption about whether you can test whether an encryption is an encryption of zero or not. And I think we need that. But I think I've seen other people making the same assumption. I mean, like I said, I'm not an expert on this, so I'm not sure, but... Yeah, we're... That what? No, it's not known whether they're possible. But there are also classical attacks on these, so... Yes? Yeah. Oh, so that's supposed to be this. Yeah, systems without structure like hidden field equations. I remembered HFE, but not... I stood for.
And also, I guess when you say
hidden
development, you mean any kind of discrete subject.
Yes.